This is Audible.
Simon and Schuster Audio presents The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, a novel by Lisa C. Read by Ruthie Ann Miles, Kamiko Glenn, Alexandra Allwine, Jeremy Bobb, Joy Osmansky, Emily Walton, Aaron Wilhelmy, and Gabber Zachman.
Part 1. The Akka Way, 1988 to 1990. A dog on the roof.
No coincidence, no story, my Amma recites, and that seems to settle everything, as it usually does, after First Brother finishes telling us about the dream he had last night. I don't know how many times my mother has used this praising aphorism during the 10 years I've been on this earth. I also feel as though I've heard versions of First Brother's dream many times. A poor farmer carries freshly picked turnips to the market town to barter for salt. He takes a misstep and tumbles down a cliff. This could have ended in a terrible death far from home, the worst thing that can happen to an Akka person. But instead, he lands in the camp of a wealthy salt seller. The salt seller brews tea, the two men start talking, and, the coincidence could have been anything, the salt seller will now marry the farmer's daughter, or the farmer's fall protected him from being washed away in a flood. This time, the farmer was able to trade with the salt seller without having to walk all the way down to the market town. It was a good dream, with no bad omens, which pleases everyone seated on the floor around the fire pit. As Amma said, every story, every dream, every waking minute of our lives is filled with one fateful coincidence after another. People and animals and leaves and fire and rain. We whirl around each other like handfuls of dried rice kernels being tossed into the sky. A single kernel cannot change its direction. It cannot choose to fly to the right or to the left, nor can it choose where it lands, balanced on a rock and therefore salvageable, or bouncing off that same rock into the mud, becoming instantly useless and valueless. Where they alight is fate, and nothing, no thing anyway, can change their destinies. Second Brother is next in line to tell his dream. It is ordinary. Third Brother recites his dream, which is worse than dull. Abba nudges me with his elbow. "Girl, tell us a dream you had last night." "My dream?" The request surprises me, because neither of my parents has asked this of me before. I'm just a girl, unimportant, as I've been told many times. Why Abba has chosen this day to single me out, I don't know, but I hope to be worthy of the attention. I was walking back to the village after picking tea. It was already dark. I could see smoke rising from household fires. The smell of the food should have made me hungry. I'm always hungry. But my stomach, eyes, arms, and legs were all happy to know I was where I was supposed to be, our ancestral home. I watch my family's faces. I want to be honest, but I can't alarm anyone with the truth. "What else did you see?" Amma asks. "In our village, power and importance go in this order. The headman, the Ruma, the spirit priest, who keeps harmony between spirits and humans, and the Nima, the shaman, who has the ability to go into a trance, visit the trees God planted in the spirit world to represent each soul on earth, and then determine which incantations can be used to heal or enhance vitality. These men are followed next by all grandfathers, fathers, and males of any age. My mother is ranked first among women, not only in our village, but on the entire mountain. She is a midwife and so much more, treating men, women, and children as they pass through their lives. She's also known for her ability to interpret dreams. The silver balls that decorate her headdress tremble, catching the firelight as she waits for my response. The others bend their heads over their bowls, nervous for me. I force myself to speak. I dreamed of a dog. Everyone prickles at this revelation. We allow dogs to live among us for three reasons, Amma says reassuringly, trying to settle the family. They are essential for sacrifices. They alert us to bad omens, and they are good to eat. What kind was yours? I hesitate once again. The dog in my dream stood on our roof, alert, his snout pointed upward, his tail erect. To me, he looked as though he were guarding our village, and seeing him made me feel confident that I would make it home safely. But the Aka people believe. Amma gives me a stern look. Dogs are not human, but they live in the human world. They are not of the spirit world, but they have the gift of seeing spirits. When you hear a dog howl or bark in the night, you know he has spotted a spirit and hopefully scared him away. Now answer me, girl, she says, pushing her silver bracelets up her wrist. What kind was yours? The whole family was sitting outside when the dog began to bark, I say, when I know perfectly well that dreaming of a dog on the roof means that he hasn't done his job and that a spirit has sneaked past the protection of the village's spirit gate and is now roaming among us. He frightened off an evil spirit. Apomie rewarded him by giving everyone in our family a chicken to eat. Our supreme god gave every man and woman his or her own chicken? First brother scoffs. And all the children, too. Every single person had a whole chicken. That's impossible. Meaningless. A fabrication. First brother looks at Abba indignantly. Make her stop. So far, I like her dream, Abba says. Go on, girl. The more pressure I feel to continue my story, the easier it becomes to lie. I saw birds in a nest. The babies had just broken through their shells. The Amma bird tapped each one gently with her beak. Tap, tap, tap. A moment passes as my parents and brothers ponder this addition. As Amma searches my face, I try to keep my expression as still as a bowl of soy milk left out overnight. Finally, she nods approvingly. Counting her babies, new lives, a protecting mother, she smiles. All is good. Abba stands up, signaling that breakfast is done. I'm not sure what's more troublesome, that Amma can't see everything inside my head as I've always thought she could, or that I've gotten away with my fabrications. I feel pretty terrible until I remind myself that I prevented my family from the worry my dream would have caused them. I lift my bowl to my lips and slurp down the last of my broth. A few bitter mountain leaves slip into my mouth, along with the fiery liquid. Chili flakes burn their way to my stomach. For as long as that heat lasts, I'll feel full. When we leave the house, stars still glitter above our heads. I carry a small basket on my back. My other family members have large baskets slung over their shoulders. Together we walk along the dirt lane that divides Springwell Village, which has about 40 households and nestles in one of the many saddles on Nanuo Mountain. Most of the homes are sheltered by old tea trees. The tea terraces and gardens where we work, however, are outside the village. We join our neighbors who live four houses away from us. The youngest daughter, Cite, is my age. I could find my friend anywhere, because her cap is the most decorated of any girls in Springwell. In addition to tea, her family grows pumpkins, cabbages, sugarcane, and cotton. They also cultivate opium, which they sell to the spirit priest to use in ceremonies and to Amma, to use as medicine for those suffering from the agony of broken bones, the torment of the wasting disease, or the mental anguish that comes from losing a loved one. The extra money Cite's family earns means they can sacrifice more and larger animals for offerings, which in turn means that the customary shared cuts of meat that are given to everyone in the village are more and larger, too. Sitei's family wealth also means that her cap is decorated with lots of silver charms. Apart from these differences, Sitei and I are like sisters, maybe closer than sisters because we spend so much time side by side. As we continue toward our work, we leave the last house behind and proceed a little further until we reach the spirit gate. Carved figures of a woman and a man are mounted on the posts. The woman has huge breasts. The man has a penis that is as thick as timber bamboo, longer than my entire height, and sticking straight out. Whittled birds of prey and vicious dogs hang from the crossbeam. Be warned. If someone doesn't pass through the gate properly, touching it perhaps, then something terrible can happen, like a death. We must all be mindful of the gate. We begin to climb. Sitei and I chatter, catching up as though many weeks have passed instead of one night. I worked on my embroidery before bed, Sitei confides. I fell asleep before my Abba had his pipe, I tell her. Hot water or tea with breakfast? Tea. Dreams? I don't want to tell her any of that. We have a long way to go, and the only other way to make the time pass quickly is through games and challenges. How many different parasites can you spot on the trees before we get to that boulder? I hoot. 9, and I win. How are you doing with your weaving? Sitei asks, knowing I haven't shown a talent for it. So boring, I holler, and the men look back at me disapprovingly. Let's see how many jumps it'll take from this rock to that one way up there. 7, and I win again. Last night, Deja, that would be Sitei's sister-in-law, said she wants to have a son. There's nothing new with that one. I point to a little rise. Bet I can beat you to the top. My feet know this route well, and I hop from rock to rock and jump over exposed roots. In places, the dirt is powdery between my toes. In other spots, pebbles poke at the soft underparts of my arches. Since it's still dark, I sense more than see the old tea, camphor, ginkgo, and cassia trees, as well as stands of bamboo towering around me. I win again, which nettles Sitei. But that happens between sisters, too. Sitei and I are close, but we compete against each other, constantly. I won our games today. She reminded me she's better at embroidery and weaving. Our teacher says I could prove I'm smart if I worked a little harder. He would never say that about Sitei. See you at the tea collection center, I say when Sitei follows her amma onto another path. I linger, watching them scramble up a steep stretch of mountain, their empty baskets bouncing on their backs. And then I skip ahead to catch up to amma. After a half hour of walking, the black of night begins to fade and the sky turns pale. Clouds catch tints of pink and lavender. Then everything brightens when the sun crests the mountain. The cicadas awaken and begin to trill. And still we climb. My Abba and brothers maintain distance ahead of us so they can have their man talk. Amma is as strong as any man, but she takes her time, looking about for herbs and mushrooms she can use in her potions. First sister-in-law has stayed home with the children too young to pick tea and too big to be carried by their mothers. But my second and third sisters-in-law accompany us with their babies tied to their bosoms as they too forage, searching the moist forest floor for anything we might take home to put in our dinner soup. We reach First Brother's tea terraces at last. I move slowly between the tightly packed rows of bushes, scanning the outermost branches for the bud and 2, maybe 3 leaves that begin to unfurl as the sun's rays warm them. I gently nip the tiny cluster between my thumbnail and the side of my forefinger above the first joint. My thumbnail is stained, and the little pad of flesh calloused. I'm already marked as a tea picker. After 2 hours, Amma comes to me. She runs her hands through my leaves, fluffing and inspecting them. You're very good, girl, at finding the choicest bud sets. Maybe too good. She glances in Abba's direction, a few terraces away, then leans down and whispers, "Pick a little faster, and you can take some of the older and tougher leaves. We need more leaves, not just ideal bud sets from each bush." I understand. More leaves means more money to be paid by the tea collection center. When my basket is full, I find First Brother, who transfers my pickings into a burlap sack, and the process begins again. We break for a lunch of rice balls rolled in dried moss and then pick all through the afternoon. I stay close to my mother, who sings to keep us in the rhythm of picking and to remove our minds from the heat and humidity. Finally, Abba calls, "Enough!" We gather at the spot where First Brother has been consolidating our harvest. The last leaves are packed into burlap sacks. Then each sack is strung with ropes and a flat board. Amma mounts the smallest one on my back, wraps the ropes over my shoulders, and secures the board on my forehead. All this is to help us carry the weight evenly, but the pull of the ropes on my shoulders and the press of the wood against my forehead are instantly painful. Once the others have their sacks on their backs and our picking baskets have been bound together for us to retrieve on our way home, we begin the 2-hour journey to the tea collection center. We're all aware we must hurry, but our pace can only be slow. One sure foot after another sure foot. We climb up and over more tea terraces, each one seemingly steeper than the last, and then we're back in the forest, which has engulfed forsaken tea tree groves and gardens. Vines wrap around the trunks, which have become homes to orchids, mushrooms, and parasites like crab's claw. How old are the trees? 500 years old? 1,000 years old? I don't know the answers. What I do know is that selling leaves from them was abandoned long ago. Only families like ours use the leaves from trees like these for at-home drinking. By the time we reach the tea collection center, I'm so tired I want to cry. We enter through big gates into a courtyard. My vision flits around the open space looking for Sitte's distinctive cap. We Aka have our own style of dress. So too do the Dai, Lahu, Bulong, and the other tribes who live here with us. Everyone wears their work clothes, but every headdress, scarf, and cap is decorated according to the traditions of that clan and the individual taste and style of each woman or girl. I don't spot Sitte. Her family must have come and gone already. They might even be home by now, eating their supper. My stomach calls to me, aggravated yet entranced by the smells coming from the food vendor stalls. The perfume of skewered meat on an open flame fills my head. My mouth waters. One day, I'll get to taste one of those. Maybe. Occasionally, we treat ourselves to scallion pancakes that an old Dai woman sells from a cart just to the left inside the tea collection center courtyard. The aroma is enticing, not as rich as the grilled meat, but cleanly fragrant with the smell of fresh eggs. Amma, my sisters-in-law, and I squat in the dirt as my Abba and brothers take our bags through a set of double doors that lead to the weighing area. On the other side of the courtyard, I spot a boy about my age lingering by a mountain of burlap bags filled with tea waiting to be transported to the big city of Menghai, where it'll be processed in a government-run factory. His hair is as black as my own. He too is barefoot. I don't recognize him from school, but I'm less interested in him as a person than I am in the steaming scallion pancake he holds in his tea-stained fingers. He looks around to make sure no one is watching, obviously missing me, before ducking out of sight behind the burlap mound. I get up, cross the courtyard, and peek around the corner of the wall of tea. "What are you doing back there?" I ask. He turns to me and grins. His cheeks are shiny with oil. Before he has a chance to speak, I hear Amma calling, "Girl! Girl! Stay near me!" I scurry back across the courtyard, reaching my mother, just as Abba and my brothers exit the weighing area. They don't look happy. "We were too late," Abba says. "They already bought their quota for the day." I moan inwardly. We're a family of 8 adults and many children. It's hard to live on what we earn during the 10 days a year of prime tea picking, the 2 secondary picking times of another 10 days each, plus what rice and vegetables we grow, and what Abba and my brothers provide through hunting. Now we'll have to take the leaves home, hope they stay fresh, and then tomorrow morning, early, climb back up here and sell them before rotating to Second Brother's tea garden to do our work for the day. Amma sighs. Another double day tomorrow. The sisters-in-law bite their lips. I'm not looking forward to walking here twice tomorrow either. But when my second and third brothers won't meet their wives' eyes, I realize even worse news is coming.
No need, Abba reveals. I sold the leaves at half price.
That's only 2 yuan per kilo. The sound that comes from Amma is not so much a groan as a whimper. All that work at half price?
The two sisters-in-law slump off to a water spout to refill our earthenware jugs. The men drop to their haunches. My sisters-in-law return and give the water to the men. After that, the two women fold themselves down next to Amma, adjust their babies in their swaddling, and give over their breasts for nursing. This is our rest before the more than 2 hour walk downhill to Springwell. As the others relax, I wander back across the courtyard to the boy.
Are you going to tell me why you're hiding back here? I ask, as though no time has passed.
I'm not hiding, he answers, although surely he is. I'm eating my pancake. Do you want a bite?
More than anything. I glance over my shoulder to Amma and the others.
I'm not sure what's wrong with me, but whatever started with my lies at breakfast continues now. I step behind the wall of bags that smell of freshly harvested tea leaves. Once I'm back there, the boy doesn't seem sure of what should happen next. He doesn't break off a piece for me, nor does he hold it out for me to take. But he offered me a bite, and I'm going to get it.
I bend at the waist, sink my teeth into the softness of the pancake, and rip off a mouthful. Like I'm a dog snatching a scrap from his master's hand.
What's your name? He asks.
Li Yan, I answer, my mouth happily full. My given name is used only at school and for ceremonial purposes. In my village, people call me Daughter of Shali, my Appa's daughter, or Daughter of Sosa, my Amma's daughter. In my family, I am girl.
I'm called Sampa, he says. I'm from Shelter Shadow Village. My father is Lo San, my grandfather was Ba Lo, my great-grandfather was Abba.
Every Akka boy is trained to recite the lineage by naming his male ancestors back 50 generations, with the last syllable of one generation becoming the first syllable of the next generation. I think that's what's going to happen, when a woman's voice, angry, interrupts him.
Here you are, you little thief!
I turn to see the old Dai woman, who runs the pancake stand looming between us in the open courtyard. She grabs the cloth of my tunic. Then, with her other hand, she takes hold of Sampa's ear. He yowls as she drags us from our lair.
Sun and moon, look! Thieves!
Her voice cuts through the clatter of the courtyard.
Where are the parents of these two?
Amma looks in our direction and cocks her head in disbelief. Until today, I've never been a troublemaker. I never cross my legs around adults. I accept my parents' words as good medicine, and I always cover my mouth to hide my teeth when I smile or laugh. Maybe I colored my dream this morning, but I'm not a thief or a cheater in school. Unfortunately, the oily residue around my mouth shows that at the very least I ate some pancake, even if I didn't steal it from the Dai woman's cart. Amma and Abba cross the courtyard. Seeing the confusion on their faces makes my cheeks burn red. I lower my eyes and focus on their calloused feet as they walk to the vendor. Soon, two other pairs of feet join us, taking spots on either side of Sunpa, his parents.
What is all this about?
Abba's voice is polite and even. He can be gruff at home, but he's clearly trying to blow away the pancake seller's anger with his polite Akka ways.
I've had trouble with this one before. The old woman gives Sampa's ear a yank. As a thief, wherever he goes, may he be eaten by a tiger. If he passes by water, may he slip into its depths. When he walks under a tree, may it fall on him.
These are common, yet potent, curses, because they're hexing him to suffer a terrible death. But the boy beside me doesn't seem to care. He doesn't even cover his mouth to hide his grin. The Dai woman regards my mother with sympathy.
Now it seems he's brought your daughter into his ring.
Is this so, girl? Amma asks.
Why would you do such a thing?
I raise my eyes. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong.
Not wrong? Amma asks.
He gave it to me.
I didn't know it was stolen.
Others crowd around us to see what's going on. Let's not allow this little girl to be blamed, the man I understand to be Sampa's Abba says. You've been in trouble in this very place before, boy. Tell everyone the truth.
I took it, Sampa admits,
but it doesn't seem to cause him any pain. He's so matter-of-fact, it's as though he's talking about rainfall or how many eggs the chickens laid last night.
He offered me a bite, I chime in. He wanted to share with me.
But Ama isn't interested in my excuses.
Now the world is out of balance for both children, she announces. We follow Aka law.
We adhere to Aka law as well, Sampa's father states. Every Aka on Earth has a shared memory of what we can and cannot do.
Then we must perform cleansing ceremonies for these two children, our families, and our villages. The only question that remains is, will the ceremony be conducted with the children together or apart?
Ama asks. Abba is the head of our family, but Ama, with her added status as midwife, conducts this negotiation.
The most propitious outcome would be if our two families could do it together.
To strangers like these, her voice must sound as smooth and warm as my Abba's during this confrontation.
This unpleasantness can be wiped away and we can all be friends. But I know her very well. What I hear is her disappointment in me and her concern for the situation.
May I ask on which day of the cycle your son was born?
Sanpa was born on Tiger Day, the ninth day of the cycle, his mother answers, trying to be helpful.
My family members shift their weight from foot to foot in response to this regrettable information. We Aka follow a 12-day week, with each day named for a different animal. I was born on Pig Day. The world knows that tigers and pigs should never marry, be friends, or farm together, because tigers like to eat pigs.
Ama reveals the bad news.
This one was born on Pig Day. Separate purification ceremonies will be best.
She courteously tips her head, causing the balls and coins on her headdress to jingle. Then she puts a hand on my shoulder. Let us go home.
Wait! It's the pancake seller. What about me? Who's going to pay me?
Sampa's father reaches into an indigo satchel tied at his hip, but Abba says,
A girl has only her reputation. As her father, I will pay the amount owed.
He pulls out a couple of coins from the paltry sum we earned today and drops them into the Dai woman's hand. I already felt bad. Now I feel awful. If Sitay had been here, I never would have gone behind that wall of tea, met Sanpa, taken a bite of the pancake.
The Dai woman yanks Sanpa's ear one more time. Let me see you going, but never coming back.
It's another familiar but haunting curse that again hints at a terrible death. Fortunately, she does not say the same words to me. Sunpa's parents begin to drag him away. He looks over his shoulder to give me one last grin. I can't help it. I smile right back. That last spark of connection sustains me all the way home. My family is clearly irritated with my actions, and they say nothing to me in a very loud way. We stop only once to pick up the baskets we left on First Brothers' terraces. We arrive in Springwell Village well past dark. The houses glow golden with open hearth fires and oil lamps. When we step into our home, we are all hungry, and the smell of the steamed rice First Sister-in-Law has made is almost painful to inhale. But we still don't get to eat. First brother is sent outside to look for a chicken. Second brother is given the job of pulling the ruma away from his evening pipe. Third brother brushes a flat stone set into the hard-packed earth outside our door with the palm of his hand. Ama sorts through her baskets, looking for herbs and roots, while first sister-in-law stokes the fire. My young nieces and nephews gather around their Ama's legs, peeping at me, their eyes wide. Second brother returns with the ruma, who wears his ceremonial cloak, which is heavily decorated with feathers, bones, and the tails of small animals, and carries a staff made from a dried stalk of tule root. He is our intermediary between the spirit world
whether inside spirits, like his ancestors, or outside spirits, who bring malaria, steal the breath from newborns, or devour the hearts of beloved grandfathers, and the world of human beings in Springwell. Tonight, he's here for me. My family gathers in the open area between the house and the newlywed huts, where my brothers sleep with their wives. First brother holds the chicken by its legs. Its wings flap miserably, fruitlessly. The village elders, who lead us and care for us, step onto their verandas and descend the stairs. Soon other neighbors emerge from their homes to join us, because I'm not to be alone in my disgrace. I see the blacksmith and his family, the best hunter and his family, Sité and her parents, and Sité's brother and his wife, Sido and Deja, who sleep in the newlywed hut outside his parents' house. Sido has always been nice to me, and I like Deja. The hair on Sido's face and scalp has grown long and unruly, because men must not shave or cut their hair once their wives are 5 months into their pregnancies. Our entire village is holding its collective breath, as it does every time a woman is pregnant, until Deja's baby is born, when it can be determined whether it was a good birth, meaning a perfect baby boy or even a girl, and not a bad birth, marking the arrival of what we call a human reject. The Ruma's eyes bore into mine. He starts to shake, and the little pieces on his headdress and clothes rattle with him. My teeth chatter. I shiver, and I want to pee.
Amamata was the mother of humans and spirits,
the Ruma says in tones so quiet that we all must lean in to hear him.
Ama means mother, and Mata means together. And once upon a time, man and spirits lived together in harmony. Amamata had two breasts in front, where her human children could nurse. She had 9 breasts on her back to nourish her spirit children. Humans always worked during the day, and spirits always worked at night. The water buffalo and the tiger, the chicken and the eagle, also lived together. But someone must always destroy paradise.
He points to me with his staff.
What was the result?
Humans and spirits, water buffalo and tigers, and chickens and eagles needed to be separated, I recite nervously.
Separated. Exactly, he says. Since the decision to divide the universe happened during the day, men were first to pick in which realm they wanted to live. They chose the earth with its trees, mountains, fruit, and game. Spirits were given the sky, leaving them angry forever after. To this moment, they have retaliated by causing problems for humankind.
I've heard the story many times, but knowing that he's telling it on my behalf makes my heart hurt.
In the wet season, he goes on, spirits descend to earth with the rain, bringing with them disease and floods. In spring, as dry season begins, noise is made to encourage malevolent spirits to move on. But they don't always leave. They're especially active at night. That is their time, not ours.
My family and our neighbors listen intently. Here and there, people click their tongues to show disapproval for what I've done. I don't want to look at anyone too closely, because I don't want to be forced to acknowledge the shame they feel for me. Nevertheless, somehow my eyes find Sité. She looks at me in pity. Nothing will hide the dishonor searing my flesh.
We worship many gods, but none is greater than Apomie, whose name means ancestor of great power. He created the world and this soul before me.
The Ruma takes a moment to make sure he has everyone's attention.
We have many taboos. Men must not smoke, nor women chew betel nut when they walk through the spirit gate. A pregnant woman, like Deja, must not go visiting to another village or she might miscarry there. A woman must never step over her husband's leg on his sleeping mat. We are always careful, and we always try to propitiate our wrongs. But please, our Li Yan did not hope to offend.
Is he saying nothing bad is going to happen to me? Then he puts his forefinger under my chin and tilts my face up to him. What Amma couldn't see in me, he sees. I know he does. Everything. But what he says to the others is very different.
She is just a hungry little girl, he explains. As the sun always comes up, as the earth is forever under our feet, as the rivers flow down the mountains and the trees grow into the sky, let us together put Lian back on the proper Akka path.
He stamps his staff on the ground 3 times. He sprinkles water over me and pats my head. He has shown me such mercy and forgiveness that I decide I'll never be afraid of him again. But when he turns away to perform the rite that will finish my purification, my stomach once again sinks. He takes the chicken from first brother's fingers, presses its body to the stone that third brother cleaned earlier, and then cuts off its head. My family has so few chickens, which means very few eggs. Now I'm the cause of the loss of food in my family. My sisters-in-law glare at me. But then... Amma takes the chicken from the ruma and swiftly plucks the feathers from the twitching carcass. Then, whack, 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 the chicken pieces are thrown into the pot that dangles over the fire first sister-in-law has been tending. 20 minutes later, Amma ladles the soup into bowls. The men gather on one side of our family home, the women gather on the other side. We sit on our haunches to receive our bowls. The sounds of greedy slurping, sucking, and chewing are among the happiest I've heard in my life. Yet frogs, mosquitoes, and night-calling birds alert me to how many sleep hours we've already missed. As I gnaw gristle from a bone, little sparks of ideas fly through my head. In my dream last night, the bad omen of seeing a dog on the roof told me I was going to get into trouble, and I did. But right now, in this second, each person in my family, as well as the ruma, has a piece of chicken to eat and rich broth to drink. That's just like in my dream, too. My fake dream, the one I lied about. But in that dream, we each had a whole chicken. Still. No coincidence, no story.
A Waterfall of Heaven's Tears. We are a people who like to roam, traveling from place to place, using the traditional practice of slashing and burning forests to create fields to plant, and then moving on when the gifts of the earth have finished being used for crops. But during the last few generations, it's become hard to claim new land on Nanuo or on any of the tea mountains in Shishuangbanna Prefecture, so we and others have stayed. Permanent. Abba says, even though the idea is against our natures. Still, our home, like all structures in Springwell Village, was built to be temporary. Before I was born, my father and grandfather went into the forest to gather the thatch that is our roof. They cut bamboo, tore off the leaves, and then tied the poles together with hand-woven lashing to create the walls that would become the separate quarters for men and women. Our house is built on bamboo stilts, providing a protected area under our feet for our livestock, although we have no pigs, oxen, mules, or water buffalo, only a few molting chickens, a rooster, and 2 ducks. The main residence and our 3 newlywed huts compose the only home I've known, but something in my blood makes me long to leave it behind for a new and different location, where my kin can place our ancestor altar and build a new dwelling as loose and with as much air flowing through it as we have right here. This restless feeling heightens during monsoon season, the months when spirits hold sway. Today, the women and girls in our household are gathered around the fire pit on the women's side of the house to do needlework. The fire gives us light and warmth, while the choking smoke helps to ward off mosquitoes. First sister-in-law and second sister-in-law have their heads bent together in private conversation. Puffy colored balls on the ends of wires wound with embroidery thread grow from first sister-in-law's headdress like a meadow of wildflowers. Second sister-in-law's headdress is fringed with a string of hollow silver balls about the size of peas that swish across her forehead like bangs. I fidget as third sister-in-law examines my needlework. Usually I have Cité at my side for these inspections, but she hasn't been allowed to visit since my bad behavior cycles ago at the tea collection center. The afternoon is interrupted when Deja and her mother-in-law arrive, bringing Amma a gift of peanuts. It's never too early to seal the bond with the women who will bring your baby into the world. But poor Deja. Usually you can barely tell when a woman is pregnant. Our clothes are sewn to be loose enough to be comfortable, while the many layers give added warmth, show family wealth, and have the clever ability to hide what's underneath. Beyond that, from childhood, girls like me are taught the proper behavior during pregnancy, so we'll have a bone-deep understanding of our responsibilities when we go into marriage. When the time comes, we should be shy about our condition and stand at an angle so our stomachs will appear less prominent. We even have a courteous way of referring to a woman carrying a baby inside her as one living under another, because she must obey her husband and never run away from him. It's hard to imagine Deja under Sido or running away from him, though, because her belly is so huge with her first baby that she looks like a melon left too long on the vine, ready to burst.
"There must be a big son in there," Amma says as she lifts the kettle from the fire. "He wants to come out and give greetings to his Amma and Abba, and most especially to his Abba's parents."
Deja smiles happily. "Let it be a son. Let it be a son. Let it be a son." She sure is reliable in her chanting, and I can see that her fealty pleases her mother-in-law, as do my Amma's comments about the baby wanting to meet his grandparents. Pregnancy is a gift to the entire village. Even I know how to recognize when a woman has come to a head, obvious from her morning sickness. Amma has taught me to identify if the baby will be a boy or a girl by the way it sleeps in its mother's womb. If a baby is more on the right side, then it will come out a boy. If it's more on the left side, it will be a girl. I need to learn these things if I'm going to follow in Amma's line by becoming a village midwife one day, as she wishes. Not only is Deja persistent with her chanting, but she's also already memorized the rules for the introduction of her baby into Spring Well. She has been careful not to curse or eat on an uncovered porch, both of which would draw too much attention to herself. When she recites, "Sido and I will refrain from the intercourse for 10 cycles after our son is born, as is proper," her mother-in-law beams proudly and comes back with the proper and happy response. "I bless you with an easy birth."
"It's good to see that Sido has also been doing his part," Amma says as she pours tea for everyone. "He's avoided climbing trees because the world knows that this might cause the baby to cry easily, which not one person in the village desires. And he engages solely in men's activities, especially hunting," Sido's Amma boasts, "to make sure his firstborn comes out a son."
"Then all should be well," Amma concludes, although I've overheard her express concern about Deja's size to the sisters-in-law. Third sister-in-law has ignored this entire exchange. Her brow is furrowed in concentration as she counts my stitches for a second time. Not a good sign. Her needlework is considered to be the most excellent in Springwell. Her headdress is covered with embroidered and appliqué designs of different creatures with special meanings. A frog and a monkey at play to show harmony. A bird with a worm in its mouth to signify her maternal love. And a butterfly whose head is embroidered to look like a lavender and yellow crab. Because she is so good at her handiwork, she can show off her expertise and creativity just for the fun of it. She finally looks up from her examination and tosses the piece of cloth back in my lap. "You'll need to pull out every stitch and do them again." Third sister-in-law is my favorite, but sometimes it feels like all she does is boss me around.
She's the mother of a son, and one day I'll marry out into my husband's home, which is why Ama tolerates it. But then, third sister-in-law goes too far by showing her sharp snout and critical tongue.
You'll never get a marriage proposal if you have to rely on your needlework.
Ama shoots up a hand to keep her from uttering another word. Nothing so untoward should be spoken directly.
Let her be, Ama says in a manner designed to end all further conversations on the subject. The girl will go to her marriage with a precious dowry. She will find someone willing to marry her, if only for that.
It's a small room, and surely Ama sees the looks that pass between the three sisters-in-law and our neighbors.
I have a dowry, true, but it's hardly precious. It's a remote tea grove high, high, high on the mountain and handed down by the women in her family. Its location is a secret because of tradition and because the grove itself is said to bring bad fortune to trespassers. Some might even call it cursed.
Come sit with me, girl, Ama continues into the awkward silence. I want to give you something.
Could it be her most prized and valuable possession? The silver bracelet with the two dragons facing each other nose to nose, which has been handed down by the women in her family?
No, because she reaches up and lets her fingers dance lightly over her headdress. She's worked on it for years, adding beads, silver balls, bells, and beetle wings. Third sister-in-law's headdress may have the finest needlework, but Amma's is truly the most exquisite in our village, befitting her status as midwife. Her fingers find their destination. Using small scissors, she snips and conceals the treasure in her hand. She repeats the process another two times before setting down the scissors. The silence in the room deepens as the others wait to see what she's going to do next.
Now that I've passed the age of 45, when women should no longer be considering childbearing, it's time that I concentrate on my only daughter and the woman, wife, and mother she'll become. Give me your hand.
The others crane their necks like geese flying across the sky. Without revealing what else she has hidden, Ama drops one of the prizes onto my outstretched palm. It's a silver coin, decorated with foreign writings on one side and a miniature dream world of temples on the other.
This coin is from Burma, she explains. I do not know what it says.
I've seen Burma on the map at my school. It's the country closest to us, but I have no idea what the Burmese characters mean either.
Next, here is a shell.
Across the room, first sister-in-law hisses air through clenched teeth. She's complimented Ama on this shell many times. I suspect she always thought it would come to her. Disappointment paints her face. But she and the other sisters-in-law should not be divvying up the charms on my mother's headdress just yet.
This last is one of my favorites. It's a feather that caravaned on the tea horse road from Tibet to our mountain. Think, girl. These things have traveled over oceans and rivers, across mountain passes, and along trade routes. Soon, you'll be able to attach them to the headdress you've been training to make, which will mark you as a girl of marriageable age.
My heart beats with tremendous joy, and yet I know that the only reason she did this was to swerve the conversation away from the unlucky land that is my dowry. 1 week later, word passes through the village that Deja has gone into labor. Her mother-in-law is attending to her, as she should in the early hours. Ama spends the morning looking through her shelves, grabbing medicines and tools from various baskets and boxes, and placing them in her satchel so everything will be ready when Sido comes to fetch her. The cautious quiet is broken when someone runs up the stairs to the men's veranda. Even before a third brother can knock on the wall that divides the two sides of the house, Ama has risen and picked up her satchel. First daughter-in-law waits at the door, ready with Ama's cape, made from bark and leaves.
Give it to girl, Ama says as she grabs another cape from a hook.
Her eyes find me.
You'll come with me today. You're old enough. If you are to become a midwife, you must begin to learn now.
The three sisters-in-law regard me with a mixture of pride and fear. I feel the same way. The idea of wearing Amma's cape makes my skin tingle with excitement, like I have ants running up and down my arms and legs. But helping her with a birth?
Ready? Amma asks.
Without waiting for an answer, she opens the door to the women's veranda. Sido has come around to our side of the house and stands in the muddy track that divides the village, rubbing his hands together with such urgency that I have to fight my desire to run back inside. Amma must sense this because she orders, "Come." The omens are particularly worrisome. It's the season of spirits. It's raining, and Deja's baby is coming earlier than expected, even though her belly has been huge for many cycles now. The only propitious sign is that it's rat day, and rats live in fertile valleys, which should help Deja in the hours to come. As we near Sido's family home, I spot Sitte peeking out the door. Her brave smile momentarily boosts my confidence. Amma and I continue on to the hut for the newlyweds. Sido leaves us at the foot of the stairs. It's a sun and moon truth that if a husband sees his wife give birth, he might die from it. Once inside, Sido's elder aunt helps us out of our capes. Amma shakes the wet from her head as she scans the room, which is even smokier from the fire than ours. Sido's mother squats on the birthing mat, her hands under Deja, massaging. Move. Amma has whittled her words down to almost nothing, having put away those parts of herself that her daughter, sister, wife, mother, and friend. She's here as the midwife. In what feels like one movement, as three trees bending together in a storm, Sido's mother slides to her right and off the birthing mat, and my Amma drops down to it, pulling me along with her. I was curious about what Sido's mother was doing when we came in, so my eyes automatically go between Deja's legs. Blood and mucus have pooled beneath her. Wow! I wasn't expecting that. Blinking, I raise my eyes to Deja's face. Her jaw is clenched in pain, her face red with effort, and her eyes squished tightly shut. When whatever has been happening seems to ebb, Amma's hands move swiftly, first prodding between Deja's legs and then moving up and over her belly in a series of squeezing motions.
Your son is giving you a hard time, Amma says. I don't know if it's Amma's words, your son, or the pleasant way she spoke in them, as though Deja's situation is no different from that of any woman who gives birth on Nanuo Mountain, but Deja responds with a smile. Amma spreads a piece of embroidered indigo cloth on the birthing mat. On this, she places her knife, a length of string, and an egg. Deja, I want you to try a different position, Amma says. Move onto your hands and knees. Yes, like that. This time, when the pain comes, I want you to take a breath, then let it out, slowly. No pushing.
3 hours later, nothing much has happened. Amma sits back on her haunches and twists the dragon bracelet on her wrist as she considers. I think we need to call the spirit priest and the shaman. Sido's mother and aunt freeze like they're barking deer spotted in the forest. The Ruma and the Nima? There's no mistaking the panic in Sido's mother's voice.
Now, please, Amma orders.
10 minutes later, Sido's Amma returns with the two men. No time is wasted. The Nima goes into a trance, but Deja's pains not only don't ease, they intensify. Her eyes remain closed. I can't imagine what horrors she must be seeing on the backs of her eyelids. Red agony. Part of me is relieved to know that not every woman goes through this. Finally, the Nima returns to our plane.
Wrong cannot be hidden. An outside spirit is insulted because Deja made a mistake in one of her ancestor offerings.
The Nima doesn't specify the injustice, but it could have been anything.
We make offerings to the mountains, rivers, dragons, heaven. We also make offerings every cycle to our ancestors. All of them involve food. So maybe an offering wasn't divided properly, or a dog grabbed some of it and ate it under the house. The Ruma takes over. He asks for an egg, not the one on the birthing mat, but a new one. Uncooked, he demands. The egg is brought, and he passes it over Deja's body 3 times as he addresses the spirit.
Don't eat or drink in this house any longer. Go back to your own place.
He puts the egg in his pocket, then speaks directly to Deja.
You've been in labor so long. We're now on Buffalo Day. Buffalo help humans in their work. Now, the spirit of the day will help you sweep the room clean of malevolence.
Deja groans as her mother-in-law and Amma help her to her feet. She cannot stand upright. Deja is dragged across the room to the broom. I open my mouth, words of objection forming. Amma catches sight of me and gives me such a stern look that my mouth snaps shut. I stand there helpless as the Nima and Ruma make sure Deja sweeps every corner. She's naked under her tunic, and bloody liquid snakes down her legs. When the Nima and Ruma are satisfied, the room is free from the bad spirit. They leave, taking gifts of money, rice, and the egg in the pocket.
Do you have the strength to squat?
Amma asks as Deja sinks onto the birthing mat. Deja whimpers as she gets into position. Think of your baby slipping out of your body as wet and slick as a fish.
The sounds that come from Deja are awful, like a dog being strangled.
Amma keeps encouraging her and massaging the opening where the baby will come out. Everything is too red for me, but I don't look away. I can't, not after already disappointing Amma. She's given me this gift, and I must try to show her my worthiness. Deja's entire body contracts, pushing hard. Then, just like Amma said it would, the baby slides out and flops onto the mat. Deja collapses on her side. The older women stare at the baby. It's a boy, but no one moves to touch or pick him up.
A baby is not truly born until it has cried 3 times, Amma recites.
He's much smaller than I expected, given how big Deja was when he was inside her. We all count. 10 toes, 10 fingers, his limbs match. 2 legs, 2 arms, equal sizes. No hare lip, no cleft palate. He's perfect. I've heard whispered what would happen if he were a human reject. Sido would have to...
Finally, the little thing cries. He sounds like a jungle bird. The first cry is for blessing.
Amma speaks the ritual words. He pulls air into his new lungs. This time, his cry is even stronger.
The second cry is for the soul.
Then comes an ear-piercing wail.
The third cry is for his lifespan.
Amma smiles as she picks him up and hands him to his grandmother. Amma ties the string around the baby's cord and cuts it with a knife. Deja pushes a couple of times, and what Amma calls the friend living with child, a gooey red blob, squeezes onto the birthing mat. This is put aside for Sido to bury under his parents' house right below the ancestor altar. Amma takes a breath, ready to give the baby his temporary name so that no bad spirits will claim him before he's awarded his proper name by his father, when Deja suddenly moans. The expressions on the older woman's faces tell me something is terribly wrong. Deja draws her knees to her chest, curling into a ball. Amma feels Deja's stomach, then quickly draws back her hands as though they've been scorched.
Tsaka, she utters. Twins. Human rejects.
Sido's aunt covers her mouth in shock. Sido's Amma drops the first baby on the floor.
The way he sucks in the smoky air sounds frantic, and his little arms jab into space as though he's searching for his mother. And Deja? She is